Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 19th of November. Coming up this hour, Senator Harry Reid announced yesterday that there is a health care reform package that is a byproduct of a merger of plans that were considered by the Senate Health Committee and the Senate Finance Committees. The House has already passed its own package, and Congress may be close to completion of reform, but there are some major questions. Of course, the big question, there are three Democrats who are worried about the health care reform and may not even want to bring the votes to open debate, which could take place this Saturday. So Senator Reid has been meeting with Ben Nelson from Nebraska and Blanche Lincoln from Arkansas, Mary Landrieu from Louisiana, to convince them to at least start the debate. There are differences. Probably the major difference between the House bill and the Senate bill is how this bill would be paid for. Instead of taxing the rich to pay for a significant piece of the bill, as the House does, the Senate plan taxes Cadillac health plans. I've always wondered exactly what those Cadillac health plans are, and we'll ask our guest as soon as we can locate her. The value of plans that would be taxed is increased from previous versions to $8,500 for an individual, $23,000 for a family of four, and higher values are allowed in high-cost states and workers in high-risk jobs, such as firefighters, police officers, coal miners, are given an exemption. Senator Kerry called the bill significant, and Durbin dubbed it complex. Kerry also said it was convoluted, this plan that businesses would be assessed a fee for not insuring their workers. So we're going to look at where we are now on health care reform, and we have a marvelous guest. We're just trying to reach her right now by phone. She has been with us many times before and really knows these bills. She's just very smart on the issue. Professor Helen Halpin, professor of health policy and director of the Center for Health and Public Policy Studies at the University of California, Berkeley School of Health, will be joining us momentarily. The second hour of our program today, a book that's hard to read, but oh my, what a writer this guy is. David Finkel will join us. He's the author of The Good Soldiers. He has won a Pulitzer Prize for work about U.S.-funded democracy efforts in Yemen. And the book, he spent 8 months with a group of soldiers in Iraq right after the beginning of the surge, and has written very movingly about the man who leads them, about what their concerns are, about the soldiers who have been killed and the soldiers who have been wounded. He says that he can't speak for every soldier, but if he thinks people were around and made a list of who wants to be here, one of the soldiers said, there's nobody who wants to be there, but they are very brave men. And the book rides a line between the reality of the situation in Iraq and that at home. And there are cutaways to congressional sessions about the apparent lack of progress on the ground. If the politicians knew just how impossible and trying the circumstances were, they'd understand why more hasn't been done. It's just a beautifully written, very absorbing, and really actually quite disturbing look at fighting, not just in Iraq, but in Afghanistan and in Vietnam and World War I and World War II. It concentrates, of course, on Iraq, but I think it's one of those timeless books that gives you an understanding, a very deep understanding of what it's like to be fighting a war. So that's coming up, hour number two. And we're still trying to reach our guest. Professor Helen Halpin will be with us. We've been doing a whole series, as you know, of reports on healthcare. We've been following this issue very, very closely. And now, as we move forward to some kind of bill, although it may be a while before that happens, we'll cover this even more. We've looked at healthcare in lots of countries throughout the world. We've looked at the kind of healthcare that federal employees enjoy. We've looked at Barbados and France and England, and we've gone to Sweden, Italy, you name it. We've just covered many, many countries, and we will cover more as we continue our conversation about healthcare reform. We're still trying to reach our guest. I don't know if her phone's off the hook. She'll probably try to be reaching us. So let me talk for a few more minutes before we open this up to you. I want to tell you a couple other things. This is an interview you may want to hear, The Audacity to Win. David Plouffe will be joining us next Tuesday on the program, The Inside Story and Lessons of Barack Obama's historic victory. He's a real sharp young guy. He began his career in politics canvassing door-to-door in Delaware and Iowa and has managed two U.S. Senate races, a congressional race, and the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee. He was lead strategist on Barack Obama's successful U.S. Senate bid, and he helped set up Organizing for America for the presidential bid. So he will be with us. He took some time off. His family increased in size after the election. I think a second child, I believe, was born right after Obama achieved victory. So he decided to spend more time looking at and helping his children grow. And he will be with us on Tuesday of next week. So we look forward to that conversation. We also want to let you know that we're on Facebook now, and it's a fun thing. Every now and then people write comments about programs, and we write comments about guests we've had on the air. So we invite you to join Facebook if you'd like to do that. All you have to do is go to WPR.org. That's PR.org, and you maneuver around, look at the front page there, and you'll see a list of all the people on the air. I think we all have Facebooks now, too, if you want to join everybody's Facebook and carry on conversation and comments about programs while we're having them or after we're finished. You just go to Kathleen Dunn, prink, and then you sign up where it says become a fan, and you do that, and then there you are, and we are, and it's kind of fun to read what you have to say, and I hope for you to listen to what we have to say. So that's something that's new. We're still trying to reach our guest. We do want to give you our phone number for on-air participation. We may have to go, if we can't reach her, to a discussion of what you think of what the Senate has given us or may give us and what the House has given us and whether or not you think the Democrats have enough votes to begin at least discussion on this by Saturday, how you would like this plan to be paid for, what your understanding of Cadillac health care plans are, or would you prefer the very wealthy among us to be having higher income taxes to pay for this plan. I'll give you our number, and I think we're going to have to go to you because I'm not sure where our guest is. I'm sure we'll be able to reach her sometime during this hour, though. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. And our email address is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. So we'll wait for some calls to come in, and we hope we'll be able to reach Helen. There's just something wrong with a phone number or something to get her on the air and chat with her about what's going on. What do you think? What do you think of the process so far? There are some people who are very concerned about any plans that have been proposed. We certainly welcome your phone calls. Again, our number is 800-486-8655. And calls are starting to come in right now. We just have to get them on the line, and then we'll be chatting with you. I'm wondering if there's anything else. We'll continue our healthcare programs. I'm not sure what day it'll be. I think it might be Monday of next week. We're going to look at the VA system of healthcare, which is quite comprehensive, and many of you use that healthcare system. Does it have problems? Is it as extensive as it should be? What does it cover? What about the people who are a part of the VA system? Are they happy with the services they receive? Would they like to see improvements? So that's coming up. And well, I'm trying to fill time here. One more thing. If you ever have suggestions, you can email Rhonda and me. Our addresses are Fanning, F-A-N-N-I-N-G, at WPR.org. And Rhonda's is, and mine is, Dunk, D-U-N-N-K, at WPR.org. And we do have Professor Helen Ann Halpin with us right now. Thank goodness I was running out of things to say. I'm never running out of things to say, as my husband will attest to, but that was about all I had for today. Professor Halpin, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much, and I'm sorry there was a typo in my phone number, and I've been sitting here waiting, but you've been dialing the wrong number.
I'm sorry. I know.
That's okay.
Yeah, I know you're so dependable, and you've been with us so many times. Thanks. It gave me a chance to just chat about
great
things. All right, question number one. Will the Democrats get the votes to open debate on Saturday?
I think they'll get the votes to open the debate. Whether or not they'll get the votes to stop a filibuster may be another question. I don't know. It's sketchy. I think if they can get through these procedural problems, they can pass a bill.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems as though conservatives have declared all-out war on this bill. And there are still a few conservative Democrats that aren't sure about the bill, to put it mildly. But I do think, actually, that this bill that Harry Reid put together is an improvement in a number of ways over the bill that went through the House. I think, actually, it looks like a pretty decent bill. Of course, there's always some things that you'd like to see that aren't there or things that are there that you wouldn't like. But they did make some compromises, it looks like a pretty solid bill. It would be hard for me to believe that if they can actually get a vote on this bill, that they can't at least get a majority to pass it. But as I said, I think they'll get the votes to open discussion. The challenge will be to close that discussion and actually get to a vote.
What are they talking about? Do they, if they don't get the votes to open discussion, they've talked about reading this bill over the course of the whole weekend. What is that?
Well, you can call. It's another delaying tactic.
I see.
You can call for the bill to be read. I know the last time, I don't know if it was for the stimulus bill, but it was recent. It was this legislative year. They did bring in a speed reader.
Oh my gosh!
Yes, to read a bill. You can see clips of it on the internet, and it's absolutely hysterical. I mean, it's almost impossible to understand what the gentleman is saying, but he actually is reading every word at a very rapid pace, and apparently he could get through this bill in a little over 24 hours.
Oh, my gosh. I'd like to see that just to see it, right?
When yes. So it's kind of silly, I think, but it's just another delaying tactic, and that's the name of the game right now, is for the people who don't want this bill to go through, is just delay, because I think they understand that should it come to a vote, there is a majority that will support this bill.
What are the procedural problems you mentioned earlier, Helen?
Well, the first is to bring it up for discussion. Then you can ask for the whole bill to be read, which doesn't delay it that long. Then it's open for amendments, and you could offer amendments till the cows come home.
Right.
At some point, you need to stop debate and call for a vote, but you also need 60 votes to do that. So there's this supermajority on these procedural votes, but then once the bill is put up for a vote, I believe now it's just a straight majority has to vote for passage. But there are all these arcane rules, you know, that are part of the checks and balances of our system, and to give everyone the opportunity to, continue to shape the legislation as it's, going through this process. But those things can be abused and used as a mean to obstruct the passage of this particular policy.
Can you tell me, and is this a major difference? The House has this increased taxes on the wealthy. The Senate has come up with let's tax Cadillac plans. I'm not sure what Cadillac plans are or which of those ideas might
sure
be better for paying for this.
Yeah, the House bill actually put a 5.4% tax on any individual who was earning more than $500,000 a year and families who were earning more than $1 million a year. The Senate took a very different approach and has actually sort of a grab bag of financing mechanisms. One of them is the one that you mentioned, what they call the tax on the Cadillac plans. And basically, if for an individual who has a plan that has an actuarial value greater than $8,500 a year, or for a family that has a health policy, health insurance policy that is worth more than $23,000 a year, those policies would be taxed at a very high rate, 40% tax on the value above those thresholds. The individual wouldn't be responsible for paying that, but the insurance company and or the employer would. So it would. I think what it would do more than anything is force the sale of policies that are below those thresholds in order to avoid what is a very high tax. The other mechanism that they're talking about is actually increasing the Medicare payroll tax for people whose wages, and this is just income earned through wages. If for an individual, if you're making more than $200,000 a year, and for a family, if you're making more than $250,000 a year, your Medicare payroll tax would go up from 1.45%, which it is now, up to 1.95%. So that's a 0.5% increase in your Medicare payroll tax for people whose wages are that high. There are also a number of, I think, really interesting financing mechanisms in this bill. One is that anyone who plans to have cosmetic surgery will now have a new 5% tax. I'm sure that plastic surgeons will not like that.
I probably not.
And probably many women who may have been looking forward to doing something like that will find that it's just suddenly become more expensive. There are also restrictions on how much executives can be paid in insurance companies, and below $500,000, health insurance companies will no longer be able to deduct wages or compensation higher than that amount for their executives as an operating cost on their taxes. There's lots of very creative financing going on here. But, I mean, the good news is that even though the total cost of the bill was projected to be $848 billion, which is below the $900 billion target that everyone's aiming for, the Congressional Budget Office yesterday came out and said that this bill would actually reduce the federal deficit by $130 billion by 2019 because the revenues that it will bring in will exceed the costs.
And the public option, a state could opt out of a public option. Why would they want to do so? And would they, do you think?
Well, it'll be interesting. What they're going to have to do is actually pass legislation indicating they don't want this option for the people in their state. Now, in some states that are solidly, Republican and very conservative, and are against anything that smacks of a government health insurance, they may politically be able to say, no, we don't want that. We only want people in our state to have the choice of private health insurance plans. For those that have made a big fuss about this, it would actually be somewhat inconsistent for them not to try to opt out of it. Although it would be interesting to see what the political pushback would be, because
it sure
even
would.
In fairly conservative states, it seems like the majority of people think they want the public option. The public option under this bill is actually much more inclusive than the one that was under the Senate bill, under the House bill, which is a good thing. It's not only open to individuals and people who work for small businesses, but if you are, if you can't afford your employer's coverage, or if your employer doesn't, well, obviously, if your employer doesn't offer coverage, but it's not worth a certain amount, or you're just unhappy with it, you can elect to go into the exchange and have the choice.
Oh, that's
interesting.
If you're
in a state that offers the public option, that's a huge difference.
Yes.
And this bill also makes a provision, I think it's by it's either 2017 or 2019, large employers will have the option of putting their employees into the exchange, which would definitely breathe life into it. I mean, the biggest fear is that the only people who will be able to get into this thing are people who are have pre-existing conditions and have poor health status, and so the cost of it will be so high it'll undergo what we first refer to in the industry as a death spiral. I think that the estimates by the Congressional Budget Office on how many people will choose these plans are way off. Their estimate for this particular, the Senate bill, is that 31 million people will be newly covered, and by 2019, 30 million people will be in the exchange, but they estimate that only 3 to 4 million of those will be in the public option. I think if we look at how these things have played out at the federal level under Medicare, when those folks that had a choice of private plans or the Medicare single-payer plan, and it's also in states where they have Medicaid managed care versus the traditional government program. What we see in almost every case is that 70 to 80% of the population chooses the public plan, not the private plans. Only 20 to 30% choose the private plans. So I think this estimate of 12% choosing the public option is just flat wrong, and rather than 3 to 4 million going into this new, what do they call it, the community health insurance option, I think it's more likely to be 20 to 25 million. Now, that would give the insurance companies a run for their money,
right,
and would meet the goal,
right,
of providing competition. 3 to 4 million, I don't think would do it.
Right. And that may explain, there's the truth of the situation, why some people, particularly insurance companies, are scared to death of this.
That's right, because I think they know over the long run it would be very difficult for them to compete with a plan that has so much lower administrative costs and the bargaining power of the federal government. That's another interesting thing about this bill, is it provides the Secretary of Health and Human Services the authority to negotiate rates with all providers and negotiate prices on all supplies.
Interesting. Well, we'll go to phone calls. We have a ton of them. I just have one more question because I don't quite understand this. If a majority of people in states like Ben Nelson's and Mary Landrieu's and Blanche Lincoln states do want some form of public option, let's talk more about the payback. How can they vote for not even having this come up for discussion or not vote for the bill? Their political payback is going to be, they're going to have people up against them who would have voted for this, and the people are in favor of it. Aren't they taking a huge political risk here?
Well, they are, and the chances that their legislature would opt out if the majority of the people want it is also slim. So it really does seem they're cutting off their nose to spite their face. I don't, it's hard to understand. It doesn't feel politically pragmatic at all.
Mm-hmm.
They're acting more ideologically than, which is strange at this stage, because I do think that the voters will seek revenge against people who vote this down. I mean, this is an extraordinary opportunity. We now have, you know, a bill that's gone through the House, a bill that's being introduced into the Senate. We're so close, you can just almost touch it. And here we have these Democrats who are in state, as you said, with a majority of the population who want this public option or community health insurance option, and yet they're saying they won't even allow it up for discussion. So I think in the end, my guess is they'll fold. The pressure just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And honestly, I would love to see Joe Lieberman and one or two other people try to filibuster this thing for weeks on end, 24 hours a day. I think they'll cave if they try.
We'll see. It's going to be a fascinating few weeks on this. We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest is Professor Helen Halpin, Professor of Health Policy and Director of the Center for Health and Public Policy Studies at the University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health. Of all of the people that we interview, she is really the most up to speed, I think. She really knows the issue. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up the second hour of our program today, for those of you who have served in war, for those of you who have never served in war and wonder what the experience really is, The author of The Good Soldiers, David Finkel, will be with us. Between January of 2007 and June of 2008, Finkel spent 8 months with a battalion of 800 U.S. Army soldiers from Fort Riley, Kansas, known as the 216. It's a very moving story, absolutely beautifully written. David will be with us, hour number two. Phone calls for Helen now. Jim from Lake Geneva, hi. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Yeah. Sorry, I was just parking here. I really enjoy your clarity, Professor. I think that I met a Dr. Linda Farley, and I have her sticker on the back of my car, and I think it's as simple as I can feel about it. And I'm a Medicare recipient for the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. And it works very well with me and my wife. But her sticker says health care for all.
Yeah.
And I think when we vote the obstructionist, will they have the opportunity to stop this the momentum behind a health care for all in our country?
Well, they're going to try. One of the headlines I saw this morning is that they've declared a holy war on the health care bill. So I think they're going to give it everything they've got. I don't honestly understand it. It just doesn't make sense to me. I think, you know, especially when you've got a piece of legislation that is being scored to actually reduce our deficit, but at the same time, you know, extend really good insurance coverage to 30 million Americans. It's hard to imagine how anyone can be opposed to that. I know people are afraid of government, but actually in the area of health insurance under Medicare, the government's done a pretty darn good job. And, of course, there's things to be improved, and all of these bills would make improvements in the Medicare drug benefit and stop giving away money to the HMOs under the Medicare Advantage plans and a number of other improvements, extending and expanding preventive care benefits so that you wouldn't have to have any copayment or cost-sharing when you go for preventive care under Medicare under these bills. So I think that you know, we've learned that when we make legislation like this, we're always going to have to tweak it and improve it. But I think the government's track record is pretty good, and it's just so unfortunate that people are choosing to prey on fears, particularly the fears of the elderly, in the process of trying to get health care for all.
Thanks, Jim. Scott from Fond du Lac. Hi.
Hi. A couple of quick points. One, I think we're still tinkering around the edges. I think we should have gone to a policy where you've got catastrophic coverage for everyone, just plain catastrophic coverage for all Americans, so no one slips through the cracks. Nobody should go bankrupt, lose their house, whatever, because they get sick. That's point number one. Point number two is maybe, and you might not be able to understand this, but maybe the people that are voting against it or have reservations is because they actually think it's a bad bill. Maybe there's some principle out there that they actually just think this is a bad bill. And so I'm going to give people the benefit of the doubt. I really hope the Associated Press, who sent 11 people to fact-check Sarah Palin's book, will spend the resources of having 11 people fact-check this plan to see if it is truly a good bill. I know I think we're just jumping to conclusions and just
well,
assuming
I spent
that...
About the last 12 hours reading it and going through it with a fine-tooth comb. It's 2,074 pages.
Wow.
I think it's, honestly, I study health policy, and health insurance policy is my area of expertise. I think it's as good a bill as we can expect with that this many people trying to forge policy in a very complex area. I wish you were right. I wish that the people who are opposed to it had read the bill and had decided it was a bad bill and actually could point to the problems. But unfortunately, if you listen to many of these people, they'll tell you they're not even going to read it.
Yeah.
And in fact, most of the senators probably won't even read the bill. And this is the real tragedy in our system, because I think people stake out ideological positions without really considering the substance of what's there and understanding it so that they can offer constructive criticism rather than just be obstructionists.
God bless you. You read the bill. That's why we love you, Helen. you read the bill. I was interested in what, and you know, it would be nice if there were a totally competing bill. I was interested in Senator Durbin's comments yesterday. The bill was posted online last night. He said, I would hope Republicans would take this opportunity to post their health care bill online. But they don't have a health care bill. But I wish they did have a health care bill. And let's look at completely competing versions of how we're going to deal with health care reform. Why not?
I actually think if they had one, there would be tremendous similarity. I mean, the whole first part of this bill is insurance reform and making sure that companies just can't drop you for no reason or for any reason, and that they won't exclude treatments or disallow you coverage because of a pre-existing condition, and they won't discriminate because of your health status, and there'll be limits on how much you have to pay out of pocket in a year or a lifetime to protect you, and they put a cap on how high your deductibles and out-of-pocket costs can be to protect people from the kind of catastrophic costs that the gentleman who just called was talking about. So these are just basic protections for anyone who's out there with insurance coverage, and I don't think there's a lot of controversy about that. I also don't think there's much controversy in another whole huge section of this bill that would make an enormous and much-needed investment in public health and health promotion and disease prevention and wellness, and make sure that everyone has coverage for the treatments that are known to be effective, and you don't have to pay anything out of pocket to get them, so that we can try and improve the health status of our population at the same time that we improve access to care. I don't think there's any controversy about that. Probably the biggest place where there's controversy is what the government's role is in expanding coverage, whereas a Republican bill would probably mandate everyone to buy private coverage. This bill, at least half of the 31 million who will be newly covered will be newly eligible for the Medicaid program or the state children's health insurance program. And in fact, the federal government picks up the tab for those programs for a number of years and then goes down to paying 90% and the state's only 10%, which is an incredible bargain compared to what the states are having to fund now, which is more like 50 or 60%. So it's very, you know, I think that they wouldn't want expansions of Medicaid, they wouldn't want expansions of SCHIP, and they definitely don't want to give the average American who doesn't qualify those programs the choice of a public plan. But my guess is that other than those three things, that actual mechanism of how you expand insurance, there's largely agreement on probably 80% of this bill. Mm-hmm. And that's what makes this so tragic. But, I mean, one of the goals is to get universal coverage. And you know, I think the private sector has had 50 years or so to prove that it could cover everyone, and it's not going to. And for good sound business reasons, they can't make money on sick people. And so there is a legitimate role, I think, for the government to step in, recognizing, I think, that healthcare is a human right, and no one should die because they don't have health insurance coverage or go bankrupt because they got sick.
Yeah, and it must be 99.9% of people would agree with what you just said. Of course they should.
I think they probably would.
Yeah. Thank you, Scott. Let's go to Rodney from Milwaukee. Hi, Rodney.
Hi. I think they need to stop calling it a health care bill. I think they should just call it an insurance reform, an insurance bill. Basically, I know how the insurance companies work because I have sickle cell disease. It doesn't make nothing simpler about dealing with insurance companies. All insurance companies have to do to keep is pay the doctors a little bit more and do what Medicare do or Medicaid. Certain physicians won't take Medicaid. Now, is there anything in the bill that says doctors have to take the public option? Do they have
No. In fact, in the Senate bill, I believe in the House bill, if you accept Medicare, then you'd have to accept payment under the public option. In the Senate bill, that is not true, and you can be in Medicare and choose not to be a provider under the public option. But it's interesting that you raise this, because the analysts that have looked at the bill are suggesting that, in fact, the rates that the government negotiates with providers might even be higher than what the private plans are paying. So if that's the case, then you would expect providers to be rushing to be a part of this plan if they feel like they're getting a better deal.
The rates might be higher. How could that be? How could that be?
See, in the House bill, they wanted to tie them to Medicare rates. Like Medicare plus 5%.
Mm-hmm.
This bill is all up to the Secretary of Health and Human Services to negotiate with the provider community under for the public plan. But, I mean, there are real problems, as this caller suggests. The payment levels for providers under Medicare are ridiculously low. I mean, they can't even cover their costs. And Medicare, depending upon where you are in the country, in California, Medicare payments actually look pretty good because the HMOs have ratcheted the payments down so far. Whereas in other parts of the country, Medicare is the low-cost payer and doctors are not wanting to join. So I think the policymakers understand that paying physicians is key to making this work.
Right.
Because if you don't pay them fairly or what they perceive to be fairly, they're not going to participate and insurance won't do you any good. The caller is absolutely right.
Thanks, Rodney. Marty from Douglas County. Hi.
Hi, good morning. I too, Kathleen, think that the professor is fabulous. I'm a great believer in calling my representatives and senators and telling them what I'm thinking. I don't know if people know that Congress has an 800 number. It's a toll-free number. Can I give that, Kathleen?
Sure.
It's 800-828-0498. And what happens is you get a switchboard operator and you ask to speak to Senator Lieberman's office, and then Senator Lieberman gives you the opportunity to either just leave a message or you can talk to a real person, which is my preference. And for the first time, I've been using this number for years. This is the first time I've ever called this 800 number, and you get a recording first off before you get an operator, and the recording says, please encourage your representatives and senators to vote for a health care bill because all Americans deserve to be covered. So my question to the senator, or to the professor, my question to the professor, who would change their mind? Who's closest to changing their mind if we flooded their offices with phone calls? I absolutely think Senator Lieberman is someone who needs to hear from everyone listening to this program right now.
Well, he does, but he also, more than anything, needs to hear from the people of Connecticut. The problem is a lot of these folks, I don't think, are listening if you're not a constituent. I mean, I don't think that means you shouldn't call. I think everyone should call because the more pressure, the better. Mary Landrieu is on the fence. Ben Nelson is on the fence. Who else? There are three of them. Ben Nelson today apparently indicated that he would allow them to put the vote on the floor for discussion.
Oh, he
and
did.
I think Mary Landrieu is still on the fence. And
Blanche Lincoln is the other.
Lincoln, yes. Yes. So those would be the three that we need to target the most today and tomorrow, because I think they're going to do that procedural vote. The latest I read was on Saturday morning.
And these were all senators?
Yes.
Landrieu, Nelson, and Lincoln.
Lincoln and Nelson, yep.
Well, normally when I call, like, Cole's office or Feingold's office, they do say, who are you and where do you live and blah, blah, whatever, so we can send you a letter and tell you we love you. I did not get that question. I'm not getting that question anymore. I'm not getting the question, who are you and where do you live so we can send you a letter. I'm just getting a poor aide who is sitting at the phone hearing people whine and complain, who never asks anymore, who are you and where are you from. So hopefully it won't matter that you're not from Connecticut or wherever else.
Well, that's very interesting. No, I mean, if they're not asking, then I say go for it.
Don't ask, don't tell. Our number is 800-486-8655, and we're happy to have as our guest today because she knows her stuff, Helen Ann Halpin. She, you don't find too many people as guests who just spent the last 12 hours, which means up all night, reading the 2,074 pages of the bill that was just brought forward from the Senate. The combination of plans from their health committee and finance committee. And we're looking at the procedural problems now, and we're looking at what's in the bill, and she of all people has a fairly good understanding of something that's hot off the press. So, two more phone calls in a moment. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program, David Finkel will join us, reporter for the Washington Post, Pulitzer Prize winner, and author most recently of The Good Soldiers, which is a story of his being with a battalion for 8 months following the surge in 2007 in Iraq. It's quite a book. All right, two more phone calls. Clyde is next from Cedarburg. Hi, Clyde.
Hi, Kathleen. Thank you very much for this series on the healthcare crisis that you've done. It's a bright spot in the American mass media. And also thank you for the variety of guests that you've presented over the months on this. It's really helpful and important. Unfortunately, it's not. There's so few people relatively out of the country that have been able to hear it. Your guest today is no exception, another one of the really knowledgeable people, experts on the issue that can help enlighten us. But there's one that seems like a bit of a blind spot, the question that she has asked several times about being perplexed, not knowing why, for example, Senator Baucus helped to put the very simple Medicare.
Oops, hello. I'm sorry. Can you call us? Wait a second. Here we go. I don't know what's happened here. Hold on, Clyde. Are you still there, Clyde?
Yes. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. We just lost our guest for a minute, so hold on, please, because I want you to have a chance to speak to her. We missed, and then we lost you for a minute, too, so we just need to hold on for a moment. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. It's I've been studying the issue for 7 years and writing about it here, and an important question is, or many of the questions that she's kind of perplexed about or mystified about, should be answered by asking the question of, or by following the money. For example, many of our legislators now not only get a tremendous amount of money while they're in office for carrying water for the insurance for the corporations, but they also they consider their legislative career as just a stepping stone, and they always have that safety valve. Like who was that? Billy Taupin from Louisiana, also, who had was discredited and couldn't stay in office in the Congress, and is now a highly paid executive with a major corporation. So the tremendous amount of influence that corporations have over our government, our elected officials, is perhaps a way to answer the question of why our senators and representatives do not even represent, don't stand for, and will actually oppose what their constituents want.
Hmm. And I guess we can't underestimate, obviously, this money thing, right, Helen?
Well, no, I don't think we can. I mean, I think this is the big problem that we have designing social policy in any area, is the amount of corporate money that's going to support these legislatures. I mean, almost all the major players that are involved have taken literally millions of dollars from the health insurance industry. Now, you might say that, you know, in some ways the industry gives to whoever has power at that moment, but you have to believe that they wouldn't be giving that level of money if they didn't think it had an effect. And, I mean, I think it's just really clear, for example, with Joe Lieberman, Aetna is based on in the state of Connecticut. Aetna is one of the largest commercial insurers in the country, and they don't want this bill, and therefore he doesn't want the bill, even though the majority of people in Connecticut do. The system is terribly, terribly broken, and I've been arguing for years that until we have publicly financed campaign, until we get this corporate money out of the Congress, we cannot do the people's business. And I really do think that, you know, there's a case in the Supreme Court right now that might take all caps off what corporations can give in the name of political speech. And I just think it could potentially be the downfall of our democracy, because you're absolutely right. Our representatives are supposed to represent us, the people,
not corporations.
Thank you, Clyde, for your call. Jan, Northern Wisconsin, hi.
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 I have a couple of quick questions. I'd like to know if the Stupak Amendment in any form is still included in this bill, because I know that's people on the left are talking about not voting for the bill if that's included.
Yes.
Also, the single payer, the rights of the states to have single payer coverage of their own was taken out in the House bill, and as a result, Dennis Kucinich voted against the House bill. I'd like to know where that is. And then lastly,
okay.
I guess could just clarify the Cadillac plans. I'm a union worker. I was a teacher, and I'm retired now, and I may be considered to have a Cadillac plan, although actually it doesn't really pay very much. I'm wondering, I'd like her to again clarify whether who's going to be taxed on this. Am I going to be taxed on the plan, or is the insurance company going to be taxed? Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Sure. I'd be happy to answer your question. The Senate bill is much more palatable in terms of the restrictions on abortion coverage compared to the Stupak Amendment in the House bill. For those who have been following this, the Stupak Amendment basically would make it very difficult to even offer any coverage in the exchange that covered abortion. And it's not clear how far that would go, but definitely for anybody who was receiving any federal money subsidies, even if they were paying a significant part of the premium out of their pocket, they would not be able to purchase a plan that had coverage for abortion. The Senate bill is much more friendly, and in fact, the Senate bill, what it attempts to do is put a firewall up between the public money and the private money, and it basically says no public money can be used for abortion, but any cost sharing that an individual has or any private part of the premium the individual pays that's not public money, that money can go towards coverage. And in fact, they go as far as saying every exchange, and in this bill, the states would run the exchanges. It would be one federal public plan that would be offered within the exchanges, but the states themselves would run them. And this bill requires that every exchange offer the choice of at least one plan with abortion coverage and at least one plan without abortion coverage, so that each individual American can choose what they want and have their premium dollars go to the kind of policy they want. And I think this does not go beyond the Hyde Amendment, and it's consistent with it, but it still will give any woman who goes into the exchange the option of getting coverage in the event they needed it for an abortion.
I think this information is published in reference to what we were talking about earlier, the influence of money. One of Judith writes, I think it would be great if what each politician receives in donations, these amounts could be published in the newspapers. They are published, aren't they?
They are, it is publicly available, but I don't think it's very accessible for most people. Now, you also asked about the single payer provision.
Yes, right.
That is not in the Senate bill, although there are provisions for states to pursue other models. So even though it doesn't say explicitly, I think that if a state wanted to set up a single payer model, they would have the option of doing that. The problem is that without considerable federal support, it would be very difficult for any state to be able to afford to do that on their own. And in terms of, I forget what the third thing was. Payer, Stupak.
Yeah, well, that's plenty.
I can't remember.
Okay. Thanks very much for the call. Well, looking ahead, we will go next to Nancy from De Pere. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning. I have just a rather technical response to one of the previous callers who said they no longer ask for your residence when you call. I actually did call my congressperson on one of what I call punch-through calls, where they get the message first and then they connect you. And the staffer I spoke to in my congressman's office, as I told him where I lived and who I was, said, I can see from the caller ID that you're calling from the Green Bay area. So that may answer that question. They no longer have to ask that. And probably 98% of the time, those numbers do accurately reflect the area from which you're calling.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Good point.
Thanks, Nancy. Christy from Oshkosh. Hi.
Hi, Kathleen. My husband and I have a question. We have a small business and we employ about 10 people. And our insurance premiums went up last year about 20%, and
wow,
they're scheduled to go up another 25% this year. And so for 10, 11 people, we're paying about $100,000, and we ask that our employees contribute and pay about 20 to 25%. But we can't continue to ask that of them and have it be a good deal for them. So what's the option going to be for us?
All right, we got about 40 seconds.
Okay, for small employers, you will automatically, all of your employees would automatically be eligible to go into the exchange and have a choice of qualified private plans or the public plan. If you wanted to continue offering coverage, the government will give you a tax subsidy to cover about 50% of your costs. So there are good options for you in this bill.
Thanks very much. Whoa, that was fast. You did that in 15 seconds, Helen. Now we have 15 seconds left. So you just give
Well, the other thing I wanted to briefly mention is
sure.
immigration. There's lots of concern about that, and this bill is much stricter than the House bill, and immigrants who are not here legally would not be able to participate in the exchange at all, whereas in the House bill, they could if they used their own money. So I wanted to make sure people understood that there was a difference in that
okay.
policy as well.
Well, you're fabulous. Thank you so much for being with us, and I'm sure you didn't get much
thank
sleep.
You.
If you read the whole darn bill in the last 12 hours, thanks. Our guest this hour, Professor Helen Ann Halpin. She's a professor of health policy and director of the Center for Health and Public Policy Studies at the University of California, Berkeley School of Public Health. She spent the last 12 hours reading all 2,074 pages of the bill that Senate Majority Leader presented yesterday, which is now online. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, John Treader for on-air production, and thanks to you for your great calls. News is coming up from National Public Radio, and we'll return with another hour you won't want to miss here on the Ideas Network.